This episode of Linoleum Knife is brought to you by RogerandChris.com.
You know, I just can't get Roger and Chris out of my head.
La, 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 la.
Boy, their furniture is all I think about. I just can't get Roger and Chris out of my head. Boy, they're infinitely customizable and full of choices and yes. Sizes and patterns and colors. Seatings is more than I dare to think about.
It's not more than you dare to think about, because you can go to RogerandChris.com and choose all those things for yourself. Whether you're getting a sofa or a nice chair like we have, or whatever kind of furniture they've got, they give you all the options to make it the way you want it to be.
Every night, every day. Just to be there in our chair. Won't you stay? Won't you lay on your Roger and Chris couch? Stay forever and ever
and ever.
Ever and ever. La, la, la. La, 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 la. La, la, la. We are actually, okay, I'm going to stop that. We are extremely satisfied Roger and Chris customers.
Yes, we are.
That is why we accept their money to do ads for them.
Mm-hmm.
I would not be doing an ad for something that I was not down for. And we've had listeners to this show write in and be like, oh, yeah, we have a chair from them, too. So you go there, you pick all your, you pick your style, you pick your fabric, you pick your colors, you pick your sizes, and then they make it here in the United States, and then they bring it to you, you know, eventually. Takes a long time to make a piece of furniture these days.
Yes.
That supply chain,
woo.
Everything's a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
But you're going to get your very exciting, very good, very sturdy, very enduring quality
yes.
piece of furniture from RogerandChris.com. Would you like to hear some theme music?
Let's.
Like you said earlier,
a podcast of the cinema
starring your name here.
I'm Alonzo Duraldi. You're Dave White.
Yes.
We're film critics. I host some other podcasts.
You do.
And I have a book out called I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies, which I co-wrote with the very funny hosts of the Deck the Hallmark podcast.
It is in stores right now. We went to the Barnes and Noble at the Grove.
Mm-hmm.
And we walked right in. And we I'm not going to sing any more songs.
Please, this is, and we're getting very deep into the deep house here.
We marched right up to the second level.
Mm-hmm.
Lady said, what can I help you find? I said, I would like to find a copy of I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies. She said, are you shopping? I said, no, he co-wrote the book. She was very excited for 20 seconds,
yes.
The amount of time it took her to show us on the shelves where the book was, spine out, not face out.
Well,
sup, Barnes and Noble. Put us on the Christmas table. I say us like I'm part of this.
I have, well, believe me, without you, there's nothing's happening.
without me in this house constantly delivering venomous hatred toward the very existence of Hallmark Christmas movies, I believe that it lends your life and your participation in the Deck the Hallmark podcast and that universe a bit of, like, electricity.
You're the sand that creates the pearl.
A frisson.
There you go.
Of intense dislike.
Well, I have been very grateful to several people who on the Linoleum Cast Instagram account
yes.
have been sending me pictures of the book, often on the Christmas table.
That's nice to know.
At different Barnes & Noble and other bookstores.
It's nice to know that in other towns, they're not jaded about
Exactly.
Alonzo Durrell there.
My name carries some weight elsewhere, apparently. No, it's not me. It ain't me. Yeah, if you do see the book in the wild, please take a picture and send it to us. DM us at LinoleumCast on Instagram and let us know, you know, the, what store and what city.
Unless anybody is confused, I'm very pro-book. It's a great book. I've read a good majority of it at this point. And I am pro-Deck the Hallmark podcast. I just hate the Hallmark Christmas movies and Lifetime Christmas movies and Netflix Christmas movies and all the other made-for-television Christmas movies that are cut from the same cheap dollar store cloth.
And you're going to be on Deck the Hallmark.
Don't you talk about that.
It's very exciting.
No, no. No, no, no. Don't jinx it now.
We'll let you know all about it
once
it's happened.
Don't count your Dave Whites.
Your chickadees before they
explode.
Okay.
In a rage.
They have a clean podcast, so just
First of all, I'm not promising the public anything about my participation in this situation. Secondly, we also have a clean podcast.
Yes.
And we've had this clean podcast for 11 years.
Yes.
And how many times have you had to bleep me in 11 years? What, a handful?
Yes, but we almost never talk about Hallmark Christmas movies on this show. Mm. So.
Yeah, but we've talked about some other despicable cultural objects.
I'm just throwing that out there as a reminder to you, because I know that these raise your rage level like few other things.
Again, last time, you know, when I went and got my my A1C checked a couple weeks ago, triumphantly.
Yes.
They also checked my blood pressure. Guess what I was? Guess what my blood pressure was that day?
Just right.
A cool 120 over 80.
Good for you.
Perfect. I had perfect blood pressure. But these Hallmark movies give me some blood pressure.
Yes. The steam comes out your ears.
You were watching one the other night that just boggled my mind. Like, there was a toy store, and they were like the legacy store of the town. Like, oh, we've been in business for 125 years or whatever, and you, every scene that they shot in this toy store, there were no toys to be found on shelves. There were wrapped Christmas presents. I guess you could just go into the store and buy a mystery box,
a pig in a poke.
Yeah, wrapped in you know, tacky Hallmark Christmas paper, And there were also like little like wall decorations. I'm like, ooh, children love those.
I think they were ornaments that were just hanging on a wall. And later, after you went to bed, they did show
a
few sad looking like teddy bears or something.
Great.
It was a terrible movie.
Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium has nothing to worry about from this dumb store and this dumb movie.
A great underrated film.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes.
You walk into Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium, and
it's,
you know what you find?
It's a toy store.
You know what you find? Wonders.
Yes.
You see toys, not just on shelves, they're flying around the room. They're hanging from the ceiling. They are interacting with you in a weird animatronic way. They are...
The sock monkey is pulling at your leg.
Yeah, they're toys. It's a magical place of toys. You set your GD Hallmark movie in a toy store. You better give me some.
See, it's hard for you not to curse when you talk about
some funky toys.
Some Monday to Pine, some Friday toys.
Some monkey fighting Monday to Friday toys.
Melon farming toys. If it makes you feel any better, the guys just reviewed that movie and declared it the very worst of the year so far.
Oh, didn't I get lucky then in the 15 minutes I sat on the couch looking at that with you?
Indeed.
Not nearly as lucky as the 15 minutes I sat on the couch last night looking at this other one with you. I don't even know if that was a Hallmark one or not, but it had some Desperate Housewives people.
That was also Hallmark, yeah.
Good Lord.
We have some real movies to talk about.
I'll be the judge of that.
You were all like, we've got six movies to cover. Ah.
Yeah, we do. We have six films to talk about today. Let's normally, we'd have like three or four, but we have six.
Well, it's that time of year.
You know? I have seen five of them.
Yeah.
You have seen the sixth.
Okay.
And we're going to start with the sixth.
And that's...
Because I want you to go for it in a quick way. Because, you know, all I can do is sit here and make comments.
Mm-hmm.
I chose not to watch this one. It is Tick, Tick, Boom.
Ah, yes.
You sat on the couch right before starting it and you said, you know what, if you want, I will take the bullet on this one for you. I said, you're going to take the bullet on Tick, Tick, Boom for me? Because of love for your spouse.
Yes, yes.
And... I watched bits and pieces as I was, you know, wandering. It was a Saturday, I think it was, Saturday afternoon, and I was sort of puttering about the apartment doing tasks,
mm-hmm.
Houseworky kind of things, Christmas decoration, sorting, right. Moving around. And here is, I'm actually going to tell you what Tick, Tick, Boom is about, even though I barely watched it.
Okay.
Tick, Tick, Boom is about a guy named...
Jonathan Larson.
Jonathan Larson, who is the guy who made Rent. Now, in the 90s, if any of you were not around for the 90s, and some of you, I'm sure, were little kids in the 90s, and you don't remember the bludgeoning phenomenon...
The Rent moment.
...of Rent. Here's what happened. A musical came to Broadway, and it was called Rent. And it purported to be a rock and roll musical. It was not. It was Broadway songs with some guitars, man. And yet, it felt fresh, because it was about, you know, the youth of the moment, the people who were in their 20s.
Yes.
Namely... people like you and me. And so, although I had just, I think, perhaps turned 30 when Rent came around. Anyway, the Rent was a juggernaut. You could not escape it.
Yeah.
When we had our very first, I'm fixing to put you on blast here. When we had our very first not legal... fake wedding ceremony in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
We had a little DIY cassette of entry music that we put together ourselves, and you chose about half the songs, and I chose about half the songs.
Entry music for
guests. Showed up. We had it in an old Art Deco movie theater in Dallas,
pre-show.
And it was nice. But it was super, you know, on the cheap, the whole day.
Yeah.
And one of the songs you chose was... 500,000,000
Seasons of Love.
Seasons of Love is the name of the song.
In my defense, it was 1997.
Yeah. So, you know, you couldn't escape it. And I will say, that's the good song in the show. Mm. The rest of them are all like, me, 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 me. I like sex toys. I'm radical. You know. You took me to see it.
Yes.
When it came, the touring company came to Dallas, I was like, everyone's running around the scaffolding, and I thought, this is fine.
That production
it's
had
fine.
A terrible sound mix.
I don't care.
No. It was important, because here's the thing. It's an almost entirely sung show.
Yes.
And so if I had not gone in having known the cast album, I wouldn't have understood a word anybody said, because it was so muddy.
I did understand what was going on, because I also knew the cast album by that point,
mm-hmm.
because of living with you.
Yes.
So, and let's go on the record here as saying that I eventually wind up learning and listening to everything Alonzo Duralde brings into the house. The same cannot be said for my spouse, who's so delicate and sensitive that he cannot handle a good 70% of the music that I like.
I don't care
it
for it.
It is not my fault. It's his. Anyway, so go on. This show... is about the Jonathan Larson,
correct?
Who very tragically and sadly died just before Rent
opened.
Yeah. Like, and that really galvanized the cast and the fans and everything.
It became part of the show's legend, I think, in a way.
Yeah, and so it was, you know, it was very emotional.
Yeah.
I, you know, thought it was quite sad, but my emotions did not translate into liking the show very much. Turns out that before Rent, Jonathan Larson made a one-man show musical starring himself as himself called Tick, Tick, Boom, and now it's a movie.
Correct.
Starring Andrew Garfield as Jonathan Larson, who lives in an apartment with all of the people from Rent. It's like a one-bedroom apartment, but there's 17 people living in there, and all of them are from Rent. And and they all yell a lot, and they sing songs about how they're not going to pay the rent, and then they sing songs about how isn't it great to be living the bohemian life, and then they sing songs about what's that other one? Anyway,
oh, there's an AIDS song.
There's also an AIDS song. I missed the AIDS song.
Tick, okay, Tick, Boom so is very is, much a dress rehearsal of ideas that he's still working out.
First to draft get to Rent, the musical. The songs sound. As I'm walking through the apartment, I'm going, oh, wait, is he listening to Rent right now? No. He's listening to he's watching the Tick, Tick, Boom. And the songs all sound like they just kind of got revamped and then became Rent. And at that, once you got Rent, okay, why do you go out and make Tick, Tick, Boom into a movie?
Well, because of the sentimentality behind the legend of Jonathan Larson.
Okay.
That he, you know, died so young, that he died on the cusp of, like, having this huge hit breakthrough with this show.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a lot of sentimental baggage for musical theater people. And this is directed by Lin-Manuel Miranda, who sort of was kind of the next big Broadway thing after the Rent phenomenon happened.
Yes.
And who is, you know, was it you that said that he is everything that Anne Hathaway was accused of being?
Yeah, in real life.
Yeah.
I mean, I am not opposed to the Lin-Manuel Miranda output of, you know, musical theater and film content.
Yes.
I have seen In the Heights. I have seen Hamilton. I like them both. But when you get Lin-Manuel Miranda on his own, he is a theater kid, and he will always be a theater kid. And that is what I said to you. I said, everything that people were yelling about regarding Anne Hathaway, how she was all like, big, big, big energy all the time. That's what Lin-Manuel Miranda does. And so
that's his brand.
It is.
And that is absolutely what this movie is.
If you are that person, live your life, be free.
Well,
it's fine. Just, I can't be around you for very long because I don't have the big energy or the camera energy or the network energy, or whatever kind of energy it is that you need, to succeed in life, but like he has it, and it is exhausting.
If you have been a theater kid, this is so your movie.
Okay,
because this is,
talk about the film.
Yeah,
because I didn't really watch it. So, I watched like 3 minutes here, 3 minutes there.
I
did enjoy all the Broadway people cameos, and that's how I knew they were Broadway people. Because I only recognized about half of them.
Yes.
And the rest of them, I thought, that must be a Broadway star.
You knew Patti LuPone and Bernadette Peters, and then you just sort of figured the rest had to be somebody.
B.B. Newworth. Yes. And that guy, Brian, from Jumping the Broom. I know them when they go into a movie.
Yes.
When they're in a film cast.
Brian Stokes Mitchell.
Brian Stokes Mitchell. I know who he is. I saw Cheetah Rivera. I saw Vanessa Hudgens. She was in something, right?
Well, Vanessa Hudgens doesn't cameo. She actually has a major role here.
Right. And wasn't she in Rent?
She was in Rent Live, the TV. Right. She was the best thing about the TV Rent.
I can't remember. I don't know how much of that I even watched.
Here's the thing. Yes, I was definitely caught up in the Rent moment when the Rent moment happened.
You are allowed to have been caught up in the Rent moment because you were a Gen X person.
I fully liked musical theater. By the time the movie came out.
Well, by the time the movie came out, we were all fed up.
It was like, oh, no, not this again. And I don't, you know, I don't think it's aged particularly well. I think it is the kind of thing that you love when you're at a certain age, and then after a certain age, you find a little embarrassing. And so, you know,
someone's going to write in and tell you how that you're insulting them right now.
Look,
let Alonzo address this letter to Alonzo.
By someone, I mean me. I know a lot of people out there who take great stock in all of the work of Jonathan Larson, whose life and career meant a great deal to them, and who are loving this movie.
Okay.
And I think this is one of those movies that's like Jell-O salad. If you like Jell-O salad, you're like, Jell-O salad. I love this. Thank you. Give me more of it. And if you don't like Jell-O salad, you're going to look at it and go, not for me, not my palate. No, thank you.
I like it with the marshmallows.
So I think this is the kind of movie where, like, if you're into it, you are into it. And if you are not into it, it's not going to meet you halfway or, like, find common ground for you. It's going to be like, you keep standing over there and we're going to do our thing over here for the people who are super into it.
And it is extremely autobiographical. And it is about... about him trying to get his first show started.
Yes, about him writing another musical that wound up going nowhere, but just all of the heartache and the hard work and the, you know, what it did to his relationship and, you know, his best friend who's gay, who like was an actor but decided like, screw it, I'm going to go be in advertising and make a lot of money instead, but then he contracts HIV because it's 1990.
Right.
You know, so it is very much about the creative process, but in kind of a self-aggrandizing way. I think that the things that make Rent date poorly for me or age poorly for me are very much in evidence here. This idea of like, I have to make a musical before I turn 30 because when I turn 30, my life is over.
Well, that's if you live in Logan's Run.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, yes, obviously in retrospect, Jonathan Larson did die young, but it was a shock to everyone. It wasn't like, you know. So that
there is that idea though among lots of people that
30 is this line in the sand.
Yeah, not even 30, just the idea that once you get older you should just give up.
If you haven't made it by then.
If you haven't, in whatever made it means to you.
Sure.
You should just give up.
Yeah.
You know, you should quit trying to do the thing you really want to do. You should quit doing the thing you love if you're a creative person, because the mass of the people don't care. You know, you might, you know, have minor success somewhere. Yeah. You might have a medium popular podcast on.
We became on podcasters in our 40s, so
no. What I'm saying is, I would like it if we could abandon the idea.
Yes.
That there is an age at which you must stop.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense. Why would you want to have less fun in life? Now, if you are banking on you know, becoming a big, you know, big fat success,
right,
perhaps you should change your idea of what success is.
Absolutely. And obviously, if you're somebody whose art or work in general involves the physical, you know, if you want to be a professional basketball player or a ballerina, yes, obviously age plays into that because at some point, you know, it becomes too much of a rigor. But anyway, so that's an ongoing thing. And it's just so jazzy.
Andrew Garfield's performance feels rather large based on, again, the few moments that I saw.
But the thing, it's hard to say though, like, for all I know, he's totally nailing the character. Because you know there are those people who always have that level of on, you know, especially, and they are often drawn to musical theater as a profession. So this could be, you know, like deadly naturalistic for all we know. I don't know that much about Jonathan Larson as a person and what he was like in day to day. But yes, watching somebody play him in a movie is a lot of that. And if a lot of that is what you're here for, then great. You get all the Jell-O salad you want, but if it is not, then it's going to be less of a pleasant sit.
It's on Netflix.
It is on Netflix.
You can see it on Netflix. Is it in theaters too?
Some, you know, bit. Yeah, in that in that there. Netflix, look, it's in theaters, nominated for Oscars way, but, you know, not in a, I'm sure now that it's on Netflix, good luck finding it.
You know what I like? In the Heights. That came out this year, too.
Yeah.
Or did it come out last year?
No, it was supposed to come out last year.
Yeah.
And got pushed back because of the pandemic, and it did open during the bubble. Like, last night I went through...
Anything that happened after March of 2020 is all one blur to me.
Well, for me, for the most part, also. But it came out during that window of time when I was going to theaters, because I saw it on the Warner lot.
Oh, you mean this summer when we had like 9 weeks where we were actually going back out into the world and doing
things? Yes, between shot
between
two
the vaccine and Delta variant.
And the Delta spikes. Okay. Yes, because I was going I was going through my list of everything I'd seen in 2021, and there's this like moment of like, oh yeah, I saw it in a theater, I saw that in a theater, and then I did not see anything in a theater for months after that.
Good news: the numbers have gone down so low in Los Angeles that we are back out into the world again, which is nice. Here's what else is nice. The documentary Julia.
Yes.
Which is about Julia Child.
Mm-hmm.
And it is co-directed by Julie Cohen and Betsy West.
Yes.
In fact, who
I just interviewed on The Wrap.
Well, a few days ago, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. And here's why you interviewed them on The Wrap. They also directed another movie that we are talking about this week called My Name is Pauli Murray.
Yes.
Two films from the same two women. One of them is just now in theaters, and the other one is currently on Amazon Prime. So, but let's talk about Julia first.
Okay.
If you saw Julie and Julia, then you kind of sort of know a good chunk of this story.
Yeah.
And you watched Meryl Streep and Stanley Tucci be adorable acting it out. But what I like about this documentary is that they go much deeper into the mechanics of how Julia Child became a TV star.
Yes.
What she was like in her business dealings. At least one of the other sort of somewhat problematic elements about her that she eventually did correct in her lifetime, which was nice to know about.
And also, I think, and context about why she was such a big deal to the American palate.
Yes. After World War II, the United States experienced an economic boom that has never been seen again. And after the relative freedom of women in the United States, and I should say, because we're also going to talk about My Name is Pauli Murray, I should specify white women in the United States.
Who, during the war years, got to leave the house and go work in factories and fill in for men in various positions of employment that they normally wouldn't have been considered for.
This was the world that Julia Child was born into. She was born in 1912, something like that, and to a very wealthy conservative family in Pasadena. She was expected to go marry a banker. Or a lawyer, or whatever.
Didn't they want her to marry the guy who like owned the LA Times or something?
Yeah, they expected her. They were already fixing her up to marry the guy who was the son of the LA Times
publisher.
Know, owners. Yeah. And she said, you know what I'm actually going to do? I'm going to go join the army. And so she joined in the 40s, the military, and she became a typist for what sort of became the CIA.
The OSS, yeah.
And she wasn't a spy, although the story runs around that she was a spy. But she did type up all of their notes. And
yeah,
so
she was privy to a lot of documents.
She knew a bunch of stuff. And then when she got out of, when World War II was over, she thought, okay, well, I met this guy and we're going to marry each other. And her father didn't like him, a guy named Paul
Child.
Child. And It went from there. They moved to Paris. She took cooking classes. She wrote a cookbook. It was a huge success in the U.S. No one in France knows who she is.
Well, yeah. That's, why would they?
I know. There is no reason why they would. Because her mission was, going back to the economic boom of post-World War II, that, you know, men went out to work and made good livings and everyone moved to the suburbs and the mommies were expected to stay home and be housewives.
And make frozen dinners.
And make frozen canned boxed foods for everybody all the time. And they kind of did because it was easy, convenient food that...
It must have seemed like magic at the time.
I don't know what got into people that made them want to eat this stuff because they all knew better. They had come from, you know, a world that didn't know that stuff. And so, you know, real food was being made before all the boxed and canned and frozen.
But think about it. During World War II, they were all being, everything was rationed.
I guess
they weren't getting really good meats.
Speaking of food.
Oh, is it pie time?
It's pie time.
We'll be right back.
No, don't. I'm just going to go take it out of the oven.
So basically,
you talk about this stuff. I'm going to go take it out. Listen, I've got a sweet potato pie that's just coming out of the oven. I made it myself.
Dig, if you will, the picture.
Yeah.
No, I think that because of World War II, people had already been not used to like having good, you know, meat, maybe not a lot of like fresh vegetables and stuff. They were already dealing with things that were canned and powdered, like powdered milk and whatnot.
Yeah, that makes
so
sense.
The post World War II boom of like that whole better living through chemistry thing, where it was like, oh, look, at the touch of a button, I can have this Swanson dinner, you know, and you know, liberate, you know, hours of cooking prep time. I'm sure people just like fell for the convenience of it all. And, you know, and so it took somebody like Julia Child to be like, oh, by the way, this is all terrible. You should eat like they do in France. Let me show you how. And that's kind of the point of her book. And then this documentary shows you how she became this sort of TV pioneer because, like, nobody was really doing this sort of demo on TV
right.
The way that she did it. Like, and it was, and she was doing it on public television, which was barely a thing.
Right.
It was still like national educational television at the time, I think.
But they, you know, the film covers sort of PBS trying to push her out when she got, in their opinion, too old.
Oh, yeah, later on.
She went off to Good Morning America, where Good Morning America was like, oh, yeah, we'll take you. And we'll just pay you a whole lot more than you ever got from PBS.
Yeah.
And, you know, how she maintained her relevance and how she became, you know, an iconic figure. They talk about the Saturday Night Live sketch that Dan Aykroyd did. Apparently she owned a VHS copy of that sketch and she would play it at their dinner parties. She thought it was delightful. They do cover an element of her life that I had heard about but didn't know got resolved. That she worked with lots of gay men and didn't really have an incredibly high opinion of them other than, you know, her pal, James Beard. And so then came the 80s. And she learned, like every other, you know, adult human being with a heart and a soul, that queer people were people. And they were suffering. And that's when she changed.
And she had, was an attorney, right? Somebody who was really close to her.
Her lawyer died.
Yeah, her lawyer died, and that sort of opened her eyes to things.
So she, and that was, I mean, they were friends as well. And so, you know, someone born in 1910, 11, whatever.
They have a learning curve.
What are you, they're going to be the way they are based on how they came up. So, but it made me happy to know that that story was out there in the world floating around, and the film wanted to
put a button on
it. To give it the resolution that was satisfying.
Yes.
You know, because you don't want to think about her being a homophobe. You know, I mean, you don't. She also made amends with the French co-author of the book that they had had a falling out over money, and they stayed friends for the rest of their lives. And so, She was good.
There's the sort of classic thing of anybody who's like a pioneer and a groundbreaker then has to contend with the next generation of pioneers and groundbreakers, and they don't necessarily always cotton to them.
I did love that moment.
The Alice Waters stuff.
Ruth Reichel was one of the talking heads in the film, and she's basically talking about, you know, Alice Waters and the new American, you know, food that came along in the 70s and 80s. And Julia Child is quoted as in an on-camera interview. She's like, oh, the vegetables, they're barely cooked.
Crunchy.
Crunchy raw vegetables.
Also, the filmmakers have some of the most gorgeous food porn I've ever seen in a movie. Like Julia talks about roast chicken, and they will just like, they have shot their own roast chicken footage, and it's, oh, do not watch this movie hungry.
Nigella Lawson is taking notes on the
sensuality,
the gloopiness of the schmaltz that you see.
Literal schmaltz.
Right. That's what I meant. Julie Cohen and Betsy West also directed My Name is Polly Murray. Yes. Now, did that play theatrically earlier this year?
Yes.
As well? It did. Okay.
So
it passed me right by when it started earlier in the year.
This is a film that kind of sprang out of their movie RBG.
Yes.
When they spent a lot of time with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Justice Ginsburg talked about Polly Murray as being a very early civil rights advocate who no one knows about, or very few people know about,
right,
who doesn't get the credit deserved for you know, being such a mover and shaker about topics that would come to the fore 10, 15, 20 years later in sort of the American discourse. Polly Murray was there very early, talking about this stuff, writing about this stuff. One of RBG's early briefs cites Polly Murray as a source. And so that was what sent the filmmakers off, like, oh, Polly Murray, we need to tell this story.
Polly Murray was black and queer and born in the...
Like 1910?
Around the same time as Julia Child, actually. And quite possibly, although they passed away in the 80s, quite possibly trans.
Yes.
It is a topic of conversation among historians now as to, you know, how does one frame Polly Murray's life? You know, they lived in a time when, you know, the language to describe the non-binary or trans experience, it hadn't come along really yet in any way that could, you know, cohere a community of people.
In the specific case of Polly Murray, however, you have Polly writing letters to doctors.
Yeah, this is all in the archives.
Yes,
so much archive.
At Harvard, there's just the Polly Murray papers. It's a staggering amount of stuff that the filmmakers dug through, which is and they told me when we had the interview this week for the wrap that at that library at Harvard, the Polly Murray archives are the most requested.
Yeah.
Of the paper. So there is definitely a new wave of understanding of Polly's importance and why, you know, I think they're going to be a much bigger deal in the discussion of American history in the decades to come.
I did not know anything about this person.
Neither did I.
At all until I watched this doc. And
I worked at The Advocate for 6 years and I've never heard of Polly Murray.
They were a lawyer. Mm-hmm. An author, a poet, a priest.
Yeah.
What else did they do?
Well, and just sort of got to a lot of stuff early. You know, 15 years before Rosa Parks, Polly Murray objects to being seated in the back of a Trailways bus, like an interstate bus.
Yeah.
And it winds up going to court.
Yes.
You know, when the sort of prevailing idea among black scholars is to go with the Plessy versus Ferguson separate but equal statute, but just make sure that things really are equal.
Right.
Polly Murray is among the early voices to say, no, let's throw that paradigm out entirely. It's unconstitutional. And then you see people like Thurgood Marshall, you know, take that across the finish line,
right?
Years later. But, you know, what I was saying specifically...
Friends with Eleanor Roosevelt, wrote letters to Eleanor Roosevelt and FDR. Like,
and basically Eleanor wrote back.
Basically just complaining about stuff and saying, why are you not addressing these human rights issues?
Right.
Why? And FDR did not respond, but Eleanor Roosevelt did, and they became friends over the decades. They had a partner.
What I wanted to get to, in talking about the archives, Pauly for years wrote to doctors asking...
Yeah, getting back to the idea of trans.
Of identity, yeah. Pauly was convinced that there would be some sort of testing that would indicate, like, undescended male testes, for instance. This is, again, a very 1940s understanding of what being trans is, but... You see this documentation of somebody who is like asking the questions and wanting to know.
I need to know how that I can address what it is that's going on inside of me.
Exactly.
And asking for testosterone therapy.
Right. So it's not a stretch to think that Pauly is a trans man in an era when maybe the definition of what a trans man is was still, you know, not commonly understood.
Right. So, but this is... I feel like we're being real scattershot about how we're talking about this film because Pauly Murray was so many things at once, like so many lives in one person, so many, you know, accomplishments and so much, you know, career accomplishment, so much personal information that you will learn watching this film and how... There's been a missing piece that lots of people don't know about. And the missing piece is this person, Pauly Murray.
What this film weirdly reminded me of is, have you ever seen Peter Jackson's Forgotten Silver?
No, but I know about it.
It's a mock documentary about this pioneer of Australian cinema who has been forgotten by history, but who actually, like, invented all of these... You know, invented the close-up, invented the sprockets in film, like all of these things. And it Leonard Maltin is interviewed in it. So, like, I've known people who've seen the movie, like, how did I never hear this person? I'm like, because this person didn't exist.
Right.
But you look at it, my name is Pauly Murray. This person did exist and did all this stuff. And somehow, unless you are, like, an academic who really, follows this stuff, and I think a new generation of trans activists who can point to Pauly Murray as somebody who... paved a lot of paths for them. You know, Chase Strangio is interviewed in this
There's
film.
A wonderful quote saying, we live in a house that Pauly Murray designed.
Yes.
And I just think that's a wonderful way of describing it because, they were relentless in their pursuit of, you know, justice for people, for black people, for women, for queer people. And tireless in their efforts.
Yeah.
And of course the archives are at Harvard. There's a college named after Pauly Murray at Yale now. So in the world of academia, the name Pauly Murray is not completely unknown.
There are a couple of books about Pauly's
life. There are books about them and books they wrote.
Yes.
That are either back in print or maybe never went out of print, probably back in print. But this documentary is so fascinating, and so you didn't know you needed to know this about this person until you watched the movie, and then you wonder why no one told you before.
Yeah, no, it's this exciting feeling of discovery of like, where has this historical figure been all my life? You know,
right.
So yeah, by all means, it's on Amazon Prime. You should absolutely.
Obviously, the answer is they lived in a time where. You know, their queerness was presented to the world as womanness.
Right.
And the and because they were black, that's...
It was easy for the dominant culture.
Double silence, right? So that's why.
Yeah.
What a good movie.
Yeah.
My name is Pauly Murray. Now, I saw something that you have not yet seen.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's the latest film from Romanian filmmaker Radu Jude.
Yes, which I'm dying to see.
It's called, here comes the title, Bad Luck Banging or Loony Porn.
Romania's Academy Awards entry this year, y'all.
Oh, okay. So here's, first of all, how do they determine what the best non-English language film is going to, how do they determine what gets on the list?
Each country
submits one movie.
Correct.
And then there's a committee that whittles it down?
Yes.
All right. So all of the Academy doesn't have to watch.
No.
There's a committee.
Yes. And it used to be a thing where
who's on that committee?
Well, that's the thing. They've actually really upgraded that committee in recent years, and that it's people who are very active participants. It used to just be if you were any old Academy member who would commit to sitting through X number of movies, you know, you got to vote, which is why for a long time the international choices were kind of on the safe side.
Well,
you
know,
but now I think actually Larry Karaszewski, if I'm not mistaken, is one of the people who really went in and kind of, you know, revamped the whole process.
Oh, good.
So you have a lot more active current filmmakers looking at this stuff. And I think, you know, it's reflected in some of the choices in recent years. You know, Collective got nominated for Best Foreign Film last year.
Right.
Speaking of Romania, my favorite film of 2020.
So here's what I want to happen. I want this film to make the short list because then I want...
You want to hear them say it on television?
First of all, I want to hear them say the title on television. And also, I want to hear stories somehow, some way, of Academy members starting to watch this film and then quitting after 5 minutes.
You want to count the walkouts at the Academy Theater?
I want to somehow count the walkouts if I can. A few years ago, Radu Jude made a film called I Do Not Care If We Go Down in History as Barbarians. My apologies currently to all the listeners, because when it came out in 2018, I was sent a DVD copy as a screener, and I didn't have time to get to it, and we never reviewed it. Mm. So when it came time to review this, I was like, I need to go back and watch the 2018 film. And I did. It is about the pressure placed on a theater director who wants to stage a reenactment of the Romanian army massacring Jewish and Roma Romanians in 1941 when Romania was on the side of Hitler. And of course, this theater director is placed under a lot of a pressure not to do this.
Yes.
And that's the whole film. Okay.
Right.
Of the Romanian New Wave, and there are many really wonderful filmmakers that have come out of that movement, Radu Jude is the guy who is probably the least likely to stick with the general approach of this sort of deadpan,
mordant humor,
blank stare realism, you know, documentary-like realism. He's more likely to go off and be stylistically strange and inventive. And I'm into it. This film is structurally inventive because it is cut into three parts, each with its own wacky, jaunty theme song. and
it's only 106 minutes.
And a hot pink title card of each for each segment. And an air of wildness. Hmm. It is about a woman named Emmy. She is a high school teacher. And in the privacy of her own home with her husband, she has made a sex tape on her phone or his phone, whichever. Somehow, their tablet gets uploaded to Pornhub. Mm. And that means that everybody can see the sex tape. Her students can see it. They're passing it around at school. And she is in the middle of teaching remotely anyway, because this film takes place during COVID. It was shot, actually, in the summer of 2020. And so the first chunk, the first part of the film, Emmy is wandering the streets of Bucharest as she's on her way to a socially distant tribunal. Basically, parents have demanded a meeting with the principal and her outside on the school grounds. But along the way, she encounters so much distress and quotidian misery among, you know, just folks in Bucharest. You know, people just angry about everything, people in a rage about COVID, about the masks, about, you know, grocery stores, you name it. Like, it is a nonstop slog that she has to trudge through to get to this meeting. Part two abandons this storyline entirely. Part two is a glossary. It is as though you were watching a very late period Jean-Luc Godard film where it's just an essay film of his thoughts and ideas. This is a roughly 30-minute digression, a glossary of terms about the historical oppressiveness of life in Romania.
Police adjective, if you will.
Yeah. And it is bleakly comic because, you know, he has an opinion about everything.
Right.
And he is absolutely on the side of pulling a socially conservative, culturally conservative, politically conservative country out of that muck. He will probably not succeed. In fact, life in Romania seems quite a bit like life in the United States right now. And so part three, you get that parent meeting. And it becomes so histrionically offensive as the people who are meeting with her pile just like lie on top of grotesquerie, on top of accusation, on top of misogyny. And she is not having it. She's like, I did this in my house. This was not supposed to wind up on the internet. But even the fact that it did wind up on the internet, it wound up on sites for adults. I am an adult. I get to do what I want in my house with my husband. And if I choose to do this, and I choose even to put it on an adults-only site, you need to control your kids and not let them onto those sites. Fix your house. I don't have a problem. And I won't tell you how it ends, because it ends in three different ways after taking you down three different stories.
Oh, like Clue.
It is sort of like the ending of Clue, and one of the ways it ends, well, I can't even tell you, because it's insane.
Okay.
And actually, some people might be offended by one of the endings, but this movie is audacious. It is currently in theaters. I assume eventually it will be streaming pretty quickly, I'm going to guess. And I haven't seen anything quite like it in 2021, which makes me, you know, cheerlead for it. It is about public and private hypocrisies and about people trying to control each other and being resentful of their own complicity in being controlled themselves. Pretty proud of myself. I can pat myself on the back just a little bit. I wrote a review of this film for The Wrap. It's currently up on The Wrap. You go to Twitter, D. Leland White at Twitter. I've posted a link to it there. But I began my review by talking about the very first season of Keeping Up with the Kardashians. When Courtney asks Kim, why did you make a sex tape? And Kim responds, because I was horny and I felt like it. Which may be the most profound and progressive thing that has ever been said on Keeping Up with the Kardashians, but I'm glad it was said all the same.
I'm glad that you worked it into a review of a Romanian New Wave movie.
Me too. King Richard.
King Richard.
We watched King Richard. King Richard is the story of Richard Williams, the father of Venus and Serena Williams. It is a film co-executive produced by Venus and Serena Williams and directed by Reynaldo Marcus Green.
Yes, who did Monsters and Men.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It stars Will Smith as Richard Williams. It stars Ingenue Ellis as Brandy Williams.
Right, or Oracine.
Yeah, and I mean, that's her nickname was Brandy. As if you listen to the dialogue, you hear them calling Serena Mika in the film because her middle name is Jamika. Uh-huh. And so that's sort of her family nickname.
Gotcha.
It's a really interesting movie.
Mm.
One that I'm not quite sure I have a handle on. Because there seem to be so many elements involved in it that I don't know enough about to speak on.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you how the story goes. Okay. The story goes like this. Richard Williams and Oracine Williams had three daughters. She had three daughters from a previous marriage. Her husband died. She was a widow. She marries Richard Williams. He had also had kids from other marriages before her as well. But when he gets together with Oracine, he has this idea that he wants to have more kids and he wants them to become either famous at something or specifically good at tennis. I can't quite sort out what the motivating factor is here, but as Richard Williams, Will Smith, says these things in the film. He's like, before they were born.
Yes, I already had a plan.
He had a plan. So I guess he had a plan to make them tennis pros.
Yeah.
You can debate whether that's
good parenting.
Good parenting or not. But here's the thing. Everything I've ever heard, seen from the Williams sisters suggests to me that they have been extremely happy doing the thing that they have done.
Well,
and that they, and if they never knew anything else, it was something that they loved and were good at and became the best in the world. So it's already, like, it's done. It's done. Lightning struck twice in this family. And I can only go on what I see in the film. Was he tough and weird? Yes. And yet it seems also at the same time that everyone wound up happy. I mean, Oracine Williams did not wind up happy. She divorced him after a while because I think he became a little too much. Will Smith portrays Richard Williams as
a little too much.
A little too much, like throughout the film. And you are meant to just sit with that. Like this really, really aggressive guy who was extremely controlling and has an unusual religious background. Like they were Jehovah's Witnesses, and I don't know. It seemed to be according to the film, it seems to be a very integral part of his life and how he expected his children to behave and how he expected his wife to be. I don't know enough about that to know. All I know is what the movie shows me.
It's an interesting story because you get these sort of opposing things.
Yeah.
Because on the one hand, you know, you look at a lot of his choices and parenting style and, you know, plans for them before they were born, all that stuff. And you think, well, that's that makes me uncomfortable. But then at the same time, it's like, but it worked. And it's like, but and the movie never says definitively whether or not it's saying everybody should do this, or if it's like the he won the lottery of lotteries, you know, that all these things came together and did work out and did make people happy and did lead to these women having great lives and becoming the top of their profession.
Yeah.
At the same time, you also get this guy who is pushing them really hard and, like, you know, expecting greatness out of them, but who also is very defensive of not burning them out early, not letting them become like Jennifer Capriati, you know, making sure that they only can play tennis if they get straight A's.
Right.
Their schoolwork always comes first. So it's interestingly complex and maybe a little baffling.
In the history of stage parents.
Yes.
Right. You see so many examples of this, so many examples of it working and not working.
Yeah.
You know, you see someone like Judy Garland, whose mother pushed her out on the stage when she was like 3.
Yeah.
And said, do it, earn a living. And
Mama Rose in Gypsy.
And
you know?
Judy Garland became one of the greatest vocalists and movie stars, entertainers of the 20th century. Now, she was also extremely troubled.
Yes.
And died young.
Yes.
Because she couldn't deal with that life. And so the question that hangs in the air is, do you push your kid to be a prodigy at something? If you think they're going to be good at it, or if you have some plan before they're even born, in the hope that maybe it will be okay. And if there's religion involved in it, is there something else that's really terrible? Like an added element of terrible to that? Like, this movie suggests that this guy did this thing, and now his daughters have made a film about him.
Yeah, that's the thing. They want this story to be told, and it's like, I don't know. I think of the mom in I, Tonya, you know, like that's the version
but
of
she
the,
was she was explicitly abusive.
Yes, but I'm saying that's closer to the version of the pushy parent, stage parent
that we know
get, that we get in
that
movies
we get
that
more
we,
often,
yeah,
right.
than something like this. So it's like, obviously, they felt like this was they wanted to celebrate him. They wanted to celebrate the way they were raised. And the way they were raised made them the people they are today. But it's, is that a thing that would work for anybody else, you know?
I don't know. Based on everything I know, which is only what I know from the film,
mm-hmm.
I don't think this is a terrible movie.
No.
I thought that the performances of Sunia Sidney and Demi Singleton as Serena and Venus were this sort of lovely girlhood,
mm-hmm.
sort of, you know,
sweet,
open, you know, determined kids who are portrayed here as being very on board for the whole ride.
Anjanou Ellis away with this whole thing for me.
Anjanou Ellis is so great. She's been around for so long and doing work consistently and is always kind of below the radar.
Yeah.
Like people don't talk about her.
Yeah.
But she gets a lot of moments in this movie. And you get a real sense that you know, the Williams sister's mother was just as important.
Oh, of course.
And a counterbalance to what could have been an extremely overbearing father.
And I think that character and that performance saves this movie from being a full-on hagiography of the dad.
Yeah.
You know, she's the one who gets... She's the really the only person who gets to look him in the eyes and tell him things.
John Bernthal does, too.
Yeah,
John Bernthal as the coach is like... You, Like, he will occasionally turn to anyone else who's listening and say, you all understand that this is a crazy person, right?
Right.
You
know. But he mostly, I think most of the other people in the movie, when dealing with the natural phenomenon that is Richard Williams, wind up just sort of sputtering.
Yeah.
You know, and there are even moments where you think, I bet it didn't quite happen like that in real life.
Right.
This character is being created as a straw man to make Richard Williams have another great, like, for your consideration speech for Will Smith, you know.
Yeah.
But Smith is good. He is very effectively, I think, inhabiting this guy.
Right.
All the aspects of this guy.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the tennis sequences are shot and edited really well. You know, that we always say we don't really care about sports, but we love a sports movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Now we already, because the movie dropped on HBO Max on Friday and into theaters, we already have a letter about the film from Shoddy. We're going to read it next week.
Yes.
Because
we'll give you time to see the movie.
Give you all time to see the movie.
She raises some valuable points.
Yeah. And I'm more comfortable with this film as a film than I am with the perhaps unusual circumstances of Richard Williams' life.
Yes,
because I don't feel like I have been given enough information to say, oh, that wasn't a good thing that you did, or what's this whole, you know, male dominating religion thing that you've got going on. You know, I don't know what's going on.
I also, and this is not the movie has no power over this at all. I do flinch over the idea of a coming wave of post hillbilly elegy type punditry from right wingers who will maybe point to this movie as, see, there's no systemic racism in this country. If you buckle down, you can accomplish anything. And it's like, that's not the takeaway message here. And the movie, I think, is even smart about, you know, they mentioned the Rodney King beatings. They mentioned things that were going on during these years that these kids are growing up.
Yeah.
And just the fact that they were from Compton and conquered the world of tennis is in itself, the movie is demonstrating as this thing that nobody thought could happen, and they made it happen.
Do you think it will be taken that way? Or do you think that the right-wing people are not going to watch it anyway?
Oh,
because Venus and Serena Williams have experienced more overt, open, sustained racist attitudes from the media, from sports media, from other athletes, from the sport itself. Like, do you think the people who would cheerlead something like Hillbilly Elegy would even bother to watch this movie?
They will, because Will Smith's in it.
Maybe.
They might.
I could be wrong.
I hope I'm wrong, but that's my spidey sense for that sort of thing is tingling already.
What about Come On, Come On?
Ooh. Good stuff.
Talk about the new Mike Mills film.
The new Mike Mills
film. Come On, Come On.
Joaquin Phoenix plays an NPR producer, basically.
They never say NPR, but
Who else would be doing this? He's going around the country talking to children about...
This is public. He works in public radio.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's NPR, you know.
It's something like that. Anyway, so he's going around, he's interviewing, you know, grammar school kids and some, like, maybe up to junior high kids around the country, and sort of asking them, what's the future going to be like for you? What is Earth going to be like for you? What do you see as, you know, the rest of your life? That kind of thing. And that part of the film is sort of documentary, because those are real interviews that he's doing. These kids aren't actors. And as he's going around doing this, his sister, who is played by the great Gabby Hoffman, is dealing with some issues regarding her husband that she has to tend to. And so Joaquin Phoenix's character winds up taking care of her 9-year-old son for a while, and actually travel. You know, the kid comes with Joaquin Phoenix on his travels. The kid is played by an extraordinary young actor named Woody Norman, who I found out later is British. And it's like, oh man, they just, they all coming over here and getting our voices right.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so this is just, it's a lovely, light little, you know, there's something about Mike Mills' films that are so humane in a way that so many other movies aren't. And, you know, giant plot things might not happen, but it's about people relating to each other, family members relating to each other, friends and lovers sort of coming in and out of each other's lives and sort of finding these moments of understanding and of feeling. So you really get a handle on, you know, Phoenix and Hoffman's relationship as siblings. Phoenix's character is somebody who is not used to being around kids, and so he's having to sort of figure out like how to hang out with his kid and have conversations and sort of also be parental and take care of things and make sure that he eats and he doesn't, you know, use up too much screen time or whatever. And it's just gorgeous.
I think about this film in the same way that I think about 20th century women.
Mm-hmm.
You said the word humane. And what I really admire about Mike Mills' films, Beginners as well, is these are regular people. Perhaps they are,
in the media.
In the media or you know, culturally sophisticated people. They've been to therapy.
Urbanites.
But they aren't jerks. No one is a jerk in his films. And he takes things that could become cliche. You know, a middle-aged man and a 10-year-old kid learn from each other. You know, I've seen that movie
before. Sure.
And this isn't that movie.
No.
This is about family members helping each other along the way.
Yeah.
Family members in need coming to each other's assistance.
Having each other's back.
And it turns out that, you know, this uncle needs his nephew. And this nephew needs his uncle. And the mom, who is also the sister to the uncle, she needs them both and she needs their help. It's a lot of conversations,
yeah.
And it's a lot of everyday scenarios in which people learn how to become better and kinder to help each other through life. And I really feel like that's the underlying text of this, of 20th century women, of Beginners, in that you are given a family and maybe some close friends, but mostly you're given a family. And if you're lucky, that family will stumble along, but do their best
to get each other through.
To get each other through. And the plot of this is so, you know, thin. It is, you know, as you said, the kid's dad is in a rehab. He's in a psychiatric facility. And mom has to go help take care. So kid's got to go with uncle for a while. This is the kind of thing that happens all the time.
I like that the kid in this movie is annoying in a kid way sometimes.
Yes.
Like sometimes, yes, he'll say something really insightful or funny, right, or wonderful, but other times he's just a giant pain. And I feel like I don't see that enough in movie kids, mm-hmm, the pain aspect that we tend to like idealize children in storytelling. And it's like, yeah, a lot of times they're only half listening to you. They're not interested in cooperating with whatever's happening at the moment. And they're just going to be needy.
That's one of the things that I think is so, what's the right word I'm looking for? Frightening about Woody Norman, the actor. I've never seen this kid before. He acts like they just pulled him out of soccer practice.
Yeah.
He doesn't appear to be giving a performance. He appears to just be on camera being a kid.
Yeah.
Then it turns out, no. He's a trained, tiny little adult man actor in the body of a 10-year-old. I haven't been this unnerved by that since I first saw Dakota Fanning at age six in that terrible Sean Penn movie, where she was poised from beginning to end, and you thought, where did they get this kid? What's happening on screen right now with this child? This kid gives such a naturalistic performance.
Yeah.
You don't know he's acting.
Yeah.
You just think he's being. And that's... it's impressive at first, and then as you learn who he is off camera, you think, oh, this is actually now terrifying. But he's really something else,
yeah.
This kid. This is one of those kid performances that winds up like... awards bodies pay attention to it at the end of the year.
And this is shot by Robbie Ryan, who's one of my favorite cinematographers right now. He did Marriage Story. He did American Honey. He did The Favorite.
Yeah.
In just the most... it's not lush black and white. It's not like, you know, an old... it's not like screwball comedy black and white. But it's...
it is warm.
It is warm, though, yeah.
And that warmth is due to, I think, the intimacy of the settings,
mm-hmm.
and of the story itself. Again, it's people in a family trying to sort themselves out, trying to keep themselves together, trying to help each other, and making it possible for each other to come to understandings about their own, you know, lives.
Sure.
Including the kid, who needs an adult to give him permission to be afraid. For his family.
Yeah.
To be afraid for, you know, why is mom gone? When's dad coming home? That right. kind of stuff. I love this movie.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that I would, but I had hopes because I do like Mike Mills. And he just, I think he has sort of just knocked it out of the park again.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
We have a letter. A letter. Mm. But before I read the letter,
yes,
I have to tell everyone that we have a Patreon.
We sure do.
And that Patreon exists for you to subscribe to extra material that we create with our mouths. We sit here and we talk and we talk and we talk and we talk. We talk about television. We talk about food. We talk about other films in deeper detail. We talk about any old thing we please. We talk about music. We talk about current events. Depending on what level of subscription you're subscribing at,
yeah,
you get a podcast called LKTV about TV, a podcast called Linoleum Knife and Fork about food. You get a podcast called Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, which is about other films, older movies that we want to talk about with you.
Mm-hmm.
You get Linoleum Nights, which is the one where we swear and talk about any old thing we please every Sunday morning live on camera. In our pajamas sometimes.
We have monthly club meetings where we all stream a movie together.
We just watched My Man Godfrey this past Saturday night with lucky, lucky people.
Yes.
We were lucky that they showed up.
We were.
Anyway, patreon.com/linoleumknife. Now the letter. This is from Sean. Subject line, a trans man's take on Titan.
Ooh, okay then.
I've sent two letters in the past with lists to be knifed, but I wanted to send this letter in response to your call to action of sorts for trans opinions of Titan. I am not a movie critic, but I am a cinephile with an English degree.
Well, then.
Well, guess what,
Sean? So is Dave White.
That's me. So you're a film critic.
Yes.
It's that easy. All you have to do is get published somewhere, and you can even do that all by yourself.
Yeah.
I'll do my best to summarize my thoughts, but there's a lot to unpack with this one. I apologize in advance for the length. Here's why we're reading one letter, because it's a long one. But here we go. As a queer trans man, I did have a lot of feelings and thoughts and throughout this viewing. But to properly set the mute... why don't I read words...
Would you?
Better. Okay. But to properly set the mood, I will describe the locale. It was at a Cineopolis, a little out of the way from my apartment, but I was the only one... it was the only one showing the film that wasn't 50 miles away. About 2 in the afternoon, I was the only one in the theater, and my seat was broken. The reclining seat had been stuck with a half-swept-out position, making my back nearly straight up and my legs straining against the weak incline. Not only was I uncomfortable from the violence and pregnancy-related subject matter, but the seat itself. I was really going through it that day.
So, Sean, if you're the only one in the theater, why didn't you move?
Well, maybe we're going to get to that in the letter. Why don't you be patient?
I will.
How about that?
Okay.
Okay.
You pronounce words right, I'll be patient.
I started out gushing over the crash-esque preamble, which I'm glad you mentioned. I included it in my last list to be knifed, and I loved your standalone episode about it. But as the murders began and the rest of the wild occurrences unfolded, I found myself frustrated. I will admit now that I was not a fan of Raw, the earlier film. I believe my main problems with Titan are similar to my problems with Raw, in that our director has a lot of ideas and wants to execute them simultaneously, and they don't always read correctly because they're constantly bumping into one another and stacking in ways that make the film feel lopsided or ill-paced. And if I'm being pulled into entirely different movie theaters when there is a story shift taking me out of the viewing experience, as if I am being pulled into entirely different movie theaters when there's a story shift taking me out of the viewing experience. But I will say, I did like Titan more than Raw. There are three distinct plot lines and metaphors that I could pick out from my first viewing. Each one has tangential strings to the others, but I would have loved to have just seen entire films with those plot lines given center stage instead of competing for attention on the screen. I don't know if it's because it's French, but I couldn't help feeling whiplash whenever the plot line or tone shifted. First, the idea of learning to love yourself despite your trauma was apparent. Spoiler warning, for anyone who has not seen Titan, we see her throughout her growing pregnancy, the motor oil leaking from her. She tries to self-abort and fails and is constantly struggling with her body, which has been affected by automobiles. I guess I should stop at this letter right now and say this letter is full of spoilers.
Yes.
If you haven't seen the film yet and you don't want to know things, this is the last thing we're going to do before the show ends, so you could pause it if you wanted to.
Although the appeal of Titan is not so much couched in the surprises, per se.
There are plenty of surprises. I've only just read one of them.
Yes.
But anyway, I'm going to keep reading the letter. Had this story stood alone without the gender stuff or the murdering, I would have found it a bit more conventional and just as effective. When she finally births the baby, it is revealed to have her same metal plate on its head, as well as a metal spine. This read to me as an acceptance of what happened to her as a child, and the spine symbolizes steadiness and resolve.
Hmm.
She is at peace and born again through this child. Second, the act of murder as a literal and metaphorical distancing from others to avoid pain. I am all for gore and violence used well. I'm a horror fan, after all. But pairing such violent and visceral murders next to gender identity stuff made me feel a bit uneasy.
Hmm.
I believe something about her trauma has made it hard for her to connect with others. She doesn't have empathy or care for anyone. Anytime someone shows affection toward her, she lashes out. It gave me major Patrick Bateman vibes, which, once again, had the film just focused on the murders and the misanthropy without the gender or the pregnancy thing, could have stood alone and been just as effective. Which leads us to the final point, the gender stuff. While I am not one of the kind of trans men who wants to give birth to children, I would love to foster kids when I'm older, there is a space that exists for trans men who want to be pregnant. For me, the relationship gained through the father, paired with her misanthropy and almost blank slate quality, speaks to how it doesn't matter what or who you are, you exist. And if you have no attachment to it at If you have no attachment to that through apathy, trauma, or what have you, it's easy to slot yourself into a role and just go with the motions. It spoke to a kind of sadness that I think mainly women feel, but can cross over to other genders. It's hard to tell if this film is coming from the perspective of a woman jealous of men's privileges, or of a trans, non-binary person who has detached from society, learning to connect through gender exploration and new, safer spaces. Regardless, it's fascinating. I found it very interesting and a little magical. I loved the shaving thing, even though it's an old wives' tale. It actually works in the film, and as a pre-T trans guy, I wanted to live vicariously, even for a moment, through this person. I think the most emotional I became was when the father said, "I don't care who you are. I love you." because that level of acceptance does speak to many trans folks who have and had unaccepting parents and find surrogate parents through older friends or community members. Another scene that speaks to the fluidity of identity outside of our protagonist is when she dances on the fire truck and utilizes her skills and really gets into the motions, dropping all pretense of masculinity apart from appearance. It confuses the men, the firefighters, and turns a jest into a moment of identity crisis. Should we be turned on? What is happening? How is he dancing like that? What is going on under there, they seem to be saying.
No homo.
Exactly. While these story beats do connect and overlap, something about their execution still bothers me. Might just be a matter of taste. Might be that I don't really like French films as much as you do. I still came away from it ready to dissect the film like a forensics team. Thank you for taking the time to read this, even if you only read it to yourselves and not on the air. I'm always happy when I get to LK in my podcast catch-up rotations and hear what you both have to say, even if we don't always agree. That's part of the fun, discussing and hashing it out with fellow movie lovers and trying to understand each other and the world and maybe learning something along the way. Hope you have a lovely week, month, and rest of the year. I'll be thinking of you, Alonzo, when I have my yearly Scrooge watch in a few weeks. Stay safe out there, kindly and queerly, Sean.
Sean, that was so great. And that was exactly the kind of letter we were hoping to get when we did ask for trans listeners to let us know what they thought about Titan. So thank you so much for that. That's really, that was some wonderful insights that we would not have come up with on our own.
Speak for yourself. I could come up with insights.
You lummox.
What I meant was, I can come up with lummoxy insights.
As a lummox American.
As a lummox American. Yes. We're done. This is the end of the podcast.
We are done. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Check out my other shows. I co-host Maximum Film on the Maximum Fun Network, Breakfast All Day, which is available as a podcast or on YouTube. And I'm currently doing Saturdays on the Deck the Hallmark podcast with Jax and Bran and Dan, and we're talking about the new Netflix Christmas movies. And again,
all of them are bad.
Stop. The Deck the Hallmark guys and I have a new book out called I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies. Pick it up wherever you get books. Support indie bookstores, but
bookshop.org is very helpful.
Also good, yes. Yeah. But just wherever you buy it, please buy it. It's a great gift, and I think you'll enjoy it too. Subscribe to this program for free at Apple Podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review there. We'll read it on the air. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Spotify, Stitcher Radio, Google Play, Amazon Music, all the places.
Yeah.
Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us at linoleumcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. Pick up his new album, Six Tape, at blueBLEU.bandcamp.com. And have a great Thanksgiving, everybody. We are...
For those who celebrate.
And we are barreling into the end of the year, which means a ton of movies are going to be opening.
Movies that we have to catch up on that we missed when we weren't going to press screenings.
That also...
It was super dangerous.
But all the...
Now all the award movies. Exactly. So it's going to be
it'll probably
be... We're going to run it and gun it.
It'll be seeping into January.
Oh, it's absolutely
no doubt. But we'll be giving it our best shot. Anyway.
I'll be giving it a medium good shot.
Well, sometimes that is your best. Thank you all for listening. We will catch you next time. And until then,
goodbye.